This is the second one with Barrowman
and nanogenes
and even more gas mask zombies.
Ugh, so creepy.
And a spaceship which may or may not still be visible to anyone.
It's called The Doctor Dances.
Here we go.
We're still on our endless voyage, all through time and all through space.
With Levine and Angels now, Dalek, Cybers, and Dude, wow!
Tennant, Smith, and Eccleston, Gallifrey, where it all began.
Doctor Who is cool again, that was Russell's master plan.
Who back when? Reviewing all new Who there is. Who back when?
Subscribe and rate on iTunes, please.
Rose and Donna, Amy Pond, Rory, Martha, and beyond. Join us on this odyssey, what other choice could there be than Who back when? Who back when?
Welcome to N010, or N010, as you will, of Who Back When, a Doctor Who podcast. I'm JD, and joining me today is, as always, Ponkin.
Hello, JD. How are you doing?
I'm copacetic.
Oh, good word. Wow.
Thank you. It was on my Word of the Day calendar.
Oh, nice.
So we are reviewing the second part of The Empty Child and the Doctor Dances today.
No freaking way. What's it called?
It's called The Doctor Dances. Or, compared to what they use the word dancing for in this episode, the episode is N0010, The Doctor Has Sex.
Oh, really? It's N010, by the way. The Doctor Has Sex?
Well, they use
oh,
dancing.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah, you're right.
As a metaphor for having sex during the entire episode. So
you are very right.
I don't think Russell T. Davis wanted to call it The Doctor Has Sex.
Well, The Doctor Dances is slightly more poetic. It's a little bit more flowery. I appreciate that.
Yeah, but there are so many other things that you could have called this episode which are better than The Doctor Dances.
Essentially, what you're trying to say is that the Doctor is wearing, like, lacy, frilly French panties as opposed to a thong.
I wasn't, but we can continue along that line of thinking if you wish.
Sure, yeah, try to get that image out of your brain.
That's what she said. So, shall we jump into a B-Scout?
Oh my god, I thought you'd never ask.
The Doctor and Rose and Barrowman tell all the zombies to go to your room, which, against all sanity, actually works.
Escaping from the hospital, the Doctor and Jack have a sonic off, comparing the size of their tools while Rose flirts with both of them, alternatively, trying to ignore the really creepy gas mask aliens who are chasing them through London.
It all culminates at the alien ambulance, where Love and Genetics join forces to give the Doctor an almost perfect day. You are welcome, people.
Oh, you took the words right out of my mouth. B-Scout over.
So, anyway, we jump right into the action, and we don't actually even get a recap, I don't think, of last week. We jump straight into the Doctor, basically.
I got a recap.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's like previously on Doctor Who. Boom, 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 boom. But yeah, you're right. We do start off exactly where we ended the last time. So they're all backed up against a corner. There are gas mask zombies approaching them. And the girl, what's her face again? Nancy?
Nancy.
Yeah, Nancy's also being pushed into a corner by the little boy.
And the Doctor tells everyone to go to their room, just like some sort of naughty parent. Or a naughty child, and they do, which is good. And the Doctor makes, you know, actually has a very good line, which is that they would have been terrible last words if it hadn't have worked.
That is a really good line. That is, like, a well-written one-liner.
Oh, it is. And considering that previously the worst last line of any Doctor was actually Colin Baker's last line, this probably would have topped it.
Yeah.
Because Colin Baker's last line was, carrot juice!
Okay. I sort of took for granted that it would top it because it's an awesome last line, but... okay, carrot juice?
I topped it by worst lines.
Okay, holy shit.
That was more what I was aiming for.
Okay, well, carrot... All right, fine. I look forward to seeing that. What happens now? Presumably they're all interconnected telepathically. I mean, later on we find out they're all essentially just one mind, right? But at the same time, the little boy, the original gas mask, patient zero, he's turning around and leaving Nancy alone as well, and he just leaves.
What we have here is actually a far better, and let's stick to New Who. This is our second two-parter, and it's a far better resolution than World War III.
Yeah, okay. Obviously, World War III was terrible.
And it's, yes, but in that one, the Doctor just pulls off a device which should have killed him already and attaches it to farting aliens. You know, this is actually a...
Well, there's a deeper psychology to this solution than in the other one.
And it...
The other one is... Have
it
you
makes
seen,
sense.
Yeah, have you seen the film Thank You for Smoking? This is a weird tangent to go on, but have you seen the film Thank You for Smoking?
I have no idea what that film is.
Oh, holy crap, you have to watch it. It's a super entertaining film. Anyway.
Are you going to give me some spoilers, like The Prestige?
No, I'm not going to spoil... Dude, The Prestige came out 57 and a half years ago. I'm well within my right to talk about it. Anyway, you should still watch it. You can still enjoy it. Get over it. Anyway... In Thank You for Smoking. This is what you're spending way too much time on this tangent. There's just one line I want to point out. They're making a sci-fi film and they want to introduce a marketing for smoking on a spaceship. But they go like, oh yeah, but you can't smoke a cigarette. You can't light a cigarette in all oxygen atmosphere. And they just go, yeah, but don't worry about it. It's sci-fi. All we have to say is, thank God we invented the, you know, thingamawhatsit. And that solves the problem. And exactly that is how they solved World War III. There's absolutely no logic. There's no reason. In fact, it actually doesn't even make sense. But all he does there is he takes off something sci-fi-y and does something else to it that is also sci-fi-y. And just because it is a science fiction series, we are meant to assume that it makes sense. That, okay, fine, this gadget is now the Deus Ex Machina. In this case, everything actually does make sense, and you don't have to judge it within the context of its genre. You just consider the psychology of it, and it's very, very clever.
I totally agree.
Anyway, that's my five cents worth. I'm going to go to bed now.
Oh, well, I have to do the rest of the podcast on my own. This should be really, really full of interesting facts and no humour. Okay, so Barrowman and the Doc now go through Jack's plan,
yeah,
which was to throw a alien ambulance, something which is totally irrelevant, to a time agent, say, look, this is really, really, really important to history, give us some money for it, and then let a bomb destroy it.
Yeah.
And apparently both the Blitz and...
Pompeii
are really good places to do this. The Doctor has been to Pompeii so many times on Volcano Day.
Yeah.
That and Jack actually calls it Volcano Day in this episode.
Yeah, he does. I was going to say, I think that's a very nice observation. But hang on, wait, can I ask you a question? You'll know this. You said he's been to Volcano Day so many times. Has he been... Is there a classic episode where the Doctor goes to Pompeii?
There is a audiobook.
Oh, really? Okay.
Called The Fires of Vulcan.
Oh, cool. Okay.
There is... Also,
which Doctor is that?
Ooh, I think it's 7.
Okay.
You know, he's actually there on Volcano Day at the same time. So, you know, as 7 and 11, isn't it, that was there in 5.
Yeah. Okay, very cool. Anyway.
So, you know, he calls it Volcano Day. And so Jack's obviously in Pompeii, or has been at some time on Volcano Day. So he should have met up with the Doctor.
And the Doctor should have met himself.
Yeah, so...
Whatever.
Yeah.
Anyway, the Doctor is not pleased with Jack's explanation.
And then we cut. To Nancy, who is caught by the Lloyds.
Yeah.
The people whose house she was looting.
Yeah, exactly.
And they bundle her into their living room.
Yeah. And she is now being reprimanded by Mr. Lloyds. We now essentially get Nancy going through, aside from the fact that she outs him as having cheated on his wife, aside from that, we have Nancy judging him for just wasting so much food. Like, there's such a tremendous spread. She was feeding 10, 12 kids with the food on this table, and now he's upset by this because what, he couldn't feed himself and his wife and one single kid for one single night, but there's enough food there to feed, like, at least 100 people.
Oh, I agree. You know, he's being gluttonous, and he shouldn't be because he is actually patriotic.
Yeah, exactly.
Or it seems to be from everything else in the house.
It's very possible that we already discussed this in the last review.
Yeah, and... We get to the point where, yeah, Nancy's almost a complete bitch here, because...
She is a bit, yeah.
She outs him as cheating on his wife.
Yep.
Outs him as gay.
Yeah. Which, given the time period, 1941,
Was bad.
Yeah, exactly. As in, there were potential social repercussions. And legal repercussions, I believe.
Correct. And breaking, all the rules of rationing, which has even worse actual sentences. And then she says, right, I want a torch, more food, and some wire cutters.
Yeah.
So she's actually now stealing the food off him as well. Yeah. So
she's blackmailing him. She's going, listen, you've done something quote-unquote far worse, and unless you do what I say now, even though I'm the thief in this scenario, I'm going to tell everyone else what you've done. And I don't even give a shit if I go to prison or whatever, but you're going to also suffer from this.
Yeah. Yeah, she's a bitch.
She's a total bitch.
And I wanted her last episode to be a companion. Not anymore. She has completely turned into Adam for me.
Why did you have to mention his name? I freaking hate him. Okay.
So anyway, scanning back to the doc, Rose and Barrowman.
Yeah.
They go to...
The room. Yeah, 308 or whatever it is, where patient zero was.
And basically, Jack uses his squirness gun to blast a hole into the door.
Time out. What do you think of this gun? This is, just to clarify, just to explain what it is, it's some sort of sonic device that can project some sonic waves that we can see, so light waves that are sonic? What? I don't really get it. Onto a solid object, which then dematerializes that somehow, and later on we find out it can rematerialize that object because it has, like, a rewind switch on it.
Okay, before you try and get into the logic of the sonic blaster,
yeah,
right?
It's sonic. It's sound waves. We're talking sound. Sonic, right?
Okay, I would like you to explain how the sonic screwdriver could do all of it can with just sonic.
Okay, I prefer to view the sonic screwdriver originally to have been literally just sonic, so everything has a certain vibration or a frequency or whatever on which it operates and exists, and by matching that frequency, you can manipulate it, and that's what the screwdriver does. I realize you need maybe a few fistfuls of salt for this, but you can't fucking dematerialize something and then rematerialize it from the other side of the wall or the door or whatever it is, wherever you are. Not with sound waves, man! This isn't a transporter gun, this is a fucking sound blaster! And also, why can we see the sound waves? Why can we see them? Tell me this, JD, I want to know.
In our review of Rose,
yeah,
we also mentioned that the sonic screwdriver produces a light beam in Rose. Doesn't in any other episode, but does in Rose.
Yeah, okay, that's true. But that's just one of several digital things that they did differently in the first episode.
Okay, and when he...
By the way, they still haven't fixed the fucking intro.
What?
You know, the opening title sequence, it's still out of sync. Sorry, guys, ladies and gentlemen, I'm really sorry. This is going to be a slight tangent. You know what? We should do it a bonus episode just about the opening themes. But, okay, check this out. If you compare Rose to, as far as I know anyway, any other freaking episode until they come up with a completely different design for the opening sequence, the opening title sequence, you know when the TARDIS comes out of one vortex, it slows down a little bit, and then it speeds off into another vortex.
Yeah, I quite like that.
It looks great. Yeah, it looks fantastically wonderful.
I still think it's a far better opening title sequence than the current one we have.
I agree. I completely agree with that. It looks beautiful. But if you compare the one in Rose, and okay, I'm just going to make one reservation here. I am by no means an expert. It's very possible that I'm making a mistake here. But seriously, compare that little sequence in Rose where the music and that animation, it's perfectly in sync. Like, it just goes, zoom, pata pata. And then it just goes into the next vortex. Compare that to what it looks like in this one, and you'll see that it's out of sync. And they still haven't freaking fixed that. Anyway, sorry, that was just on my mind. Check it out. Yeah, yeah. And then try to enjoy that opening title sequence. You're welcome.
Anyway, the blaster comes from the weapon factories of Villengard.
Yes, that's very true.
And basically, he sonics the door while the doctor's telling him that the weapons factory got blown up and they've now been replaced by banana groves.
Yeah. And who blew them up?
The doctor.
Yeah, well done, Doc.
And yeah, so he's now, they're all in the room. And this room is a little tad creepy. It's a bit messed up.
It's like the most psycho freaking baby was taken over by the devil, then had a nursery built for it, then spent a little bit of time in that nursery and then escaped and blew up at the same time.
That's exactly what happens. And then the doctor finds a tape recorder of Constantine, that's Richard Wilson's character's, interview with the boy.
Yeah.
And basically you get the, are you my mummy, are you my mummy?
While they're talking. Like, they're in this room, they're talking about what's going on, and we hear the tape in the background. I have a question for you, though. So the reason I said, and as it exited, it blew up, is that when they enter, it's like an interrogation room scenario where you have the kids' room, the nursery, and then there's what I can only assume is either there used to be a pane of glass or like a one-way mirror type thing. And on the other side of that glass or mirror, there was like an observation room. That's where the tape recorder is.
Yeah.
But it seems as though the glass or the mirror or whatever has just blown out. Like, whatever was inside has physically escaped, not like mentally or whatever, has literally just fought its way out, you know. And this is a baby, well, not a baby, this is a child who, by the doctor's own admission, does not yet realize that he has the power of, as he says, a god. So what happened? Why was there a struggle there?
And also, adding on to that, the child has the powers of a god is not really the explanation of what the child is that we find out later.
No, that's true.
In the same episode.
No, I think this almost qualifies as the doctor being wrong. Like, he's still theorizing, he hasn't solved it yet.
Yeah, the doctor is completely bullshitting to be big for his companion and new love interest.
Oh, nice.
So, anyway, this scene now turns really creepy and really good.
Yeah.
Because the doctor's going there and saying, you know, he's more powerful than he realizes, he's got the power of a god. And that sound you can hear is the tape having run out 30 seconds ago.
Yeah.
And you can still hear,
are you my mummy?
And the doctor realizes that everyone got told to go back to their room, including the child.
And they are now in its room.
Two things here.
Okay.
First of all, I think this scene is amazing, and it's probably my favorite scene in the entire episode.
Yeah, yes, I'm going to agree with you. I agree. It's a fantastic scene, but I still want to put a pin in it.
You put a pin in it, and I'm going to take that pin and draw it all over something in this scene. Well, first of all, before I do that, we date Jack from being in the 51st century.
Yeah.
I'm going to take a pin that I placed last episode and pull it out.
Oh, yeah. Oh.
In the Tom Baker episode, The Talons of Wen Chiang.
Yes, I remember you saying this. Okay, go for it.
The villain was called Magnus Greel.
Is he the time agent or something?
No, Magnus Greel mistakes the Doctor for being a time agent.
Okay.
And Magnus Greel thinks the Doctor is a time agent from which century?
The 51st century.
Exactly.
Fantastic. Okay.
So, you know, Russell T. Davis likes adding little notes in. And this is obviously, because it could not be more deliberate.
Yeah.
The 51st century is where time agents came from, and that was referenced in Classic Who.
I think that's fantastic. Not even in Classic Who, when they reference themselves, as in when they reference Classic Who, are they that consistent?
No.
Harking back to, for instance, the point I made in Dalek Master Plan, where he goes, yeah, it's the year 4000, 1000 years ago when the Dalek invasion of Earth happened, you know, that one that happened 1800 years ago. Like, Russell T. Davis, much better at this than they were back then.
Well, he is a fan, and I've got great hope for... Well, Tennant was a fan of Doctor Who, and he tried to keep things consistent as well, even down to changing the title of his character in the credits from being Doctor Who to being The Doctor.
Nice.
Because he turned around and said, well, the character's not Doctor Who, it's The Doctor. I want my name as The Doctor.
Yeah.
And of course, Capaldi is a bigger Who fan than practically anyone.
Anyone, yeah.
So, okay. my pin, which I'm still got, and I'm going to take it and I'm going to drag it all over this tape recorder.
Oh, okay.
Now, the tape recorder does not fit in this time zone at all.
Oh,
First of all, it does look a bit modern. But it seems strange that a doctor in a hospital would have a high-quality reel-to-reel tape recorder of a type which the Nazis had developed, and it was called the magnetophone.
Wait, what?
Magnetophone.
Yeah, no, wait. The Nazis developed this particular brand of tape recorder?
What they developed was a reel-to-reel tape recorder with high-frequency bias. And that's what they used during the war, and they were the only ones that had it, because towards the very end of the war, the British or the Americans, I can't remember which, actually stole one, and that's now in a museum.
Oh, wow.
But at this point, a tape recorder, this clean and clear, of a reel-to-reel nature, would only have been used by the Nazis, which probably says a lot about Dr. Constantine that we haven't been told.
Yeah, I would say so. Well, either that or possibly it happened to be... This tape recorder was in the 1940s drawer at the BBC, and... And one of the set designers just went, yeah, well, this seems to be the right place. I'm just going to get one of these and pop them in here.
You ruin all my fun.
Yeah, I don't think anyone will notice this except possibly that guy, JD, who keeps writing into us. Telling us about his tape recorder trivia.
See, I don't just have Doctor Who trivia, I have tape recorder trivia as well.
I think that's fantastic. Okay.
Anyway, Jack points his gun at the kid, but it's not actually a gun he points, it's a banana.
Yeah, and why is that? Because the Doctor has done the old switcheroo on it, and there we go. They run off, I think. No, he fires it at the wall, and they escape through the wall. And that's when we get the reversal function of the gun, right? Because they okay, so correct. Shoots a hole in the wall. It doesn't shoot a hole. He dematerializes a square in the wall. They climb through this square hole, and then on the other side, they press the fast return switch, basically, on this gun. And hey presto, all of a sudden, the wall has been regenerated through sonic waves.
Yeah, let's just move on from you and your sonic wave fascination. It happens.
Okay, tell me another thing, though. Just out of curiosity, when he
I have less problem with sonic waves rematerializing a wall than I do slightly out of date reel-to-reel tape recorders, and that's probably more my problem than yours.
Very possibly. Okay, tell me this though, because I am really curious. When he rematerializes the bit of wall, does it rematerialize from the wrong side? As in, does it rematerialize what he just dematerialized?
No, it goes back as it would have gone back, as if he hadn't pressed the button in the first place.
Okay, well, I'm glad that you told me that, because that's really all I wanted to know.
I don't know why either. Anyway, they're running through the hospital. They're being chased by an empty child and loads of gas mask zombies.
All of the other zombies turn up, and the kid is on the other side of the wall, is now punching his way through the wall. This tiny child!
Yes, but considering that previously he's been shown the ability to have telekinesis, he could just rip the wall apart, and apparently he did rip a load of stuff apart in the room in the first place.
That's true.
So this is it shouldn't be called the empty child, it should be called the completely inconsistent child.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Why? There should be no violence in this child whatsoever.
Because it makes no sense when you find out why this child is how he is.
Exactly.
Anyway, to get away from the zombies, they point the gun at the floor and basically fall through it, and then they reintegrate the ceiling.
The ceiling bit, yeah.
Rewind the ceiling.
Which I'd like to think is now upside down, so that there's like a ceiling lamp sticking out of the floor one floor up.
Which would make more sense. Anyway, thankfully, the battery has run out in the Deus Ex Machina.
Yeah.
And
now they like lock themselves in a storage room or something, and we get a tiny little bit of banter where Jack is, he's kind of taking things pretty easily. He's sitting back, he's still flirting with Rose. He is still to this point flirting with her. Doctor goes, "Where did you find this cad?" And Jack is in the most flirtatious manner, just goes, "Well, you know, she had a, whatever it was, a Zeppelin, and I had an invisible spaceship. She..." Whatever. God, fuck it, I can't remember the line. Like, of all the invisible spaceships in all the world, she had to fall onto mine, basically.
And then they have a sonic off.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Sorry, yes, they have the sonic off.
And honestly, it's another brilliant line of those comparing sonics. Because it is obviously the Doctor and Jack trying to decide on who's the alpha male in front of Rose.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They're competing.
I think it deserves a soundbite.
Soundbite?
Dare we, Barrowman?
We dare.
Soundbite.
Who has a sonic screwdriver?
I do.
Lights.
Who looks at a screwdriver and thinks, ooh, this could be a little more sonic?
What? You've never been bored?
There's got to be a light switch.
Never had a long night. Never had a lot of cabinets to put up.
And then what happens is that Jack has vanished into thin air.
Yeah, exactly. They turn their backs on him for 1 second, then they look back and Rose notices, holy crap, Jack's gone. And then we cut back to Nancy, and she's now back with her rail yard kids. She's back at the train station where they all live, and all the kids are there, and one of them is hammering away on a typewriter, even though we find out he can't read or write. He's writing a letter to his dad. It's actually quite endearing in a way. Like, he's just there. He doesn't really know what a typewriter is, but he still wants to write a letter to his dad. And in this scene, there are really only two things, I think, that happen. Number one, she wants to clarify to these kids that, listen, she's not going to be around forever. And it's, in fact, her that the gas mask boy is after. Not them, her. So she needs to leave. They need to learn to take care of themselves. And the second thing has to do with the typewriter. Because, and this is where the pin I dropped earlier on with the Nazi tape recorder... It's the exact same thing. They have recycled the same plot device within the space of maybe 5 minutes. And that, I think, is a little bit sloppy.
No.
Okay. All right.
And I'll tell you why.
Counter-argument. Go for it.
Is it sloppy? Yes. But they have a reason for it.
Okay.
This episode underran quite significantly. And they needed to add in an extra scene. And... they didn't have Eccleston or Piper. What they did have was Nancy and the kids.
Okay.
So this entire scene was literally thrown in.
Ham-fisted at the end.
Everything else had been recorded in order to make the episode run to time.
Okay.
So yes, it is exactly the same basic structure as 5 minutes ago. but it has a reason.
There is an explanation for it. Okay, fair enough. No, I understand that. Whatever. Force majeure. But just to clarify, it is absolutely identical. The kid stops typing. They keep talking, but we can still hear the typing, just like we could still hear, "Are you my mummy? Are you my mummy?" And then they turn around, they look at the typewriter, and it is now typing on its own accord. Because somehow the kid is now the same kid who telekinetically closed the door and was punching through a wall, and has no ESP as far as we know, is now somehow Fringe-esque controlling the typewriter and just writing, "Are you my mummy? Are you my mummy?"
For no apparent reason as well, because the child is nowhere near them. The child is actually with the Doctor and Rose.
Exactly. Makes very little sense.
And we find this out because Jack has basically beamed up to his ship.
Yeah.
And for some reason, all the security codes have come back on his ship. Because it's not his ship, he stole it.
Of course
so he can't teleport Rose and the Doctor up yet. So he contacts them via something which is called an Omcom.
Yeah. So I believe we dropped a pin in this in the last review as well.
Oh yes, we're coming back to that pin straight
away. Sweet. Okay.
Which basically allows him to communicate with anything that could normally communicate. So like a radio.
Anything with a speaker.
Anything with a speaker.
Yeah. Even if it's unplugged.
Correct. So now we find out, because the inconsistent child starts talking, "Are you my mummying?" through the same speaker that Jack's talking through.
Yeah. And as he was before on the telephone and on the TARDIS phone, even though... Oh, wait, hang on. Shit. There are two Duracell gorillas in the last episode. There's one, the actual Duracell gorilla that we're going to get to in a second. But there's also the TARDIS phone, which, according to the Doctor, isn't actually a phone, so it doesn't actually have a speaker. It's a gorilla.
Yes, but it's a more logical gorilla
it's
than the gorilla.
It's a more logical gorilla, sure, but it's still a Duracell gorilla.
You're right. So, shall we get onto the pin in the Duracell gorilla?
Yes, please, let's do. Yeah, a mechanical toy, monkey, or gorilla, or ape. I actually still don't really know the difference between monkey and ape, whatever. A mechanical toy monkey with symbols has no built-in speaker. Yet, this kid can omcom through this freaking toy.
And it can make it clap for no apparent reason.
Yeah.
Because it has telekinesis, even though it shouldn't have, because it makes no sense when you find out what happened to it.
Yeah.
Makes no sense. Anyway. At this point, basically, they don't want to be, "Are you my mummied anymore?" So Jack starts playing his love song to Rose over the sound of the voice. And now we get Rose saying to the Doctor, Oh, Jack is so wonderful. Jack will come and rescue us. Jack's a lot like you, except he knows how to dance."
Ooh. Which basically means he has sex appeal.
Yeah, and the Doctor goes, "Well, I dance."
Yeah, and it's, you know what, Rose? Because there is no time constraint here, and because we're not being chased by crazy gas master zombies or a fucking insanely strong telekinetic monster baby, I'm going to prove to you that I can dance. And then he doesn't.
No, because instead he takes her hands and points out the fact that they are pristine.
Yeah, exactly. Even though she was hanging from however far up in the air from this balloon, this Zeppelin-esque balloon, her hands are completely untarnished. And this is, I think, where he pieces it together.
Yeah, at least starts to. And Rose says, "Well, Captain Jack made me feel all better."
Oh, yeah. Do you reckon he directed some of those nanogenes at something other than her hands, perhaps?
Oh, probably. She's all wet.
Well, you know, since you put it that way, now I'm feeling all steamy.
Anyway, the Doc and Rose get teleported up to the Pleasure Palace.
I'm sorry, I've not been paying attention since you said wet. They get teleported up, yes. They start dancing, sort of, as in they're not. They're holding on to each other. Kabalamatron, boom. They are now suddenly on the ship. He has transported them up. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
And the Doctor points out that, right, hold on, it can't have been your security protocols because, well, you know, you'd have taken a few seconds. This isn't your ship. This is a Chula warship.
Yeah, i.e. the same kind of... Is it the same... Which Chula, I'm assuming, is a civilization. Like, that's a people. That's an alien race, right?
It is an alien race. And and an Indian restaurant in London.
And an Indian restaurant in London, of course. Sorry, my bad. But it's also the same alien race that created the ambulance that crashed in London.
Correct. So he puts his hands out and the nanogenes fix him because he apparently burnt himself at the start of the other episode.
Mm.
So the Doctor has now pieced everything together in his own head, but hasn't told us yet.
Yeah, exactly.
And what he's doing here is the Doctor says, right, let's go to the Chula medical ship, the thing that crashed.
Yeah.
And Jack, in a moment of empathy he hardly ever has, realizes that, well, Doc is not exactly liking Jack at this point.
Sure.
And we get a lovely piece of exposition, actually, about Jack's back history.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the backstory. The memory thing. Go for it.
Please. You explain about the memory thing.
Well, there's not much to say, really. As far as I recall, Jack explains that he used to be a time agent. That's number one. And then he quit the agency, and just to counter any argument that, oh, you know, you're a traitor, you turned your back on the Force, essentially. He says, yeah, but there was a reason I left the agency, because all of a sudden I realized that they had stolen 2 years of my memory. There were 2 full years of my life that I couldn't remember. So I left the agency, and now I'm fighting to regain my memory. I want to remember what I did. And that's it, essentially. So now we have a reason to sympathize with him.
We do indeed. He's had 4 seasons of Torchwood.
Mm-hmm.
He has been in 11 episodes of Doctor Who.
Do we find out what happened during those 2 years?
It is never even vaguely mentioned.
Oh, Jesus Christ, I feared that you might say that. Are you serious? Are you serious?
Possibly one of the most interesting bits of Captain Jack's backstory is never actually touched upon. And considering it is a wet dream for a writer to be handed a piece of information like this, to at some point go back and say, right, this is what you did. You were a mass murderer for 2 years. Or this is what you did. You, in fact, destroyed 18 civilizations and then birthed a new star. It's never, ever mentioned.
Oh, that's insane. It's the kind of plot device that you would find in a Joss Whedon series.
Joss Whedon will have written something in for it.
Yeah, exactly. He would probably have put something in along the lines of, yeah, he did something absolutely horrendous, and then he had to save the world, but in a way he then somehow ordered or forced his own memory to be erased, and now he doesn't remember that he did it himself of his own volition, and in order to save everyone. Fuck it, let's not even theorize about what Joss Whedon would have done. But either way, it is, you're right. It would be fantastic. I mean, any writer would just splooge in their pants given this opportunity. Why is it never picked up on?
No one knows.
Are the other Captain Jack episodes, are they also written by Russell T? Some of them are, surely.
Well, no, hold on. This episode is not written by Russell T. Davis. This episode is written by Stephen Moffat.
Sorry. Wait, the Moff... Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. We talked about this the last time. The Moff wrote this. So the Moff must have written other Captain Jack episodes, right? Surely.
No, I don't think he did.
Okay.
Because Boomtown is Russell T. Davis.
Okay.
Bad Wolf Parting of the Ways is Russell T. Davis. Utopia, Sound of Drums, Last of the Time Lords. Sounds like they would have been done by Russell T. Davis. Stolen Earth and Journey's End is Russell T. Davis, and The End of Time is Russell T. Davis. And then Torchwood was Russell T. Davis.
Yeah, okay. I still feel like that's a pretty big plot point to just ignore.
Yeah, but from everything we know about Russell T. Davis, he likes continuity.
Yeah, exactly. So, all right. Okay.
Anyway,
yeah, let's carry on.
We skip over to Nancy the blackmailer.
Yeah.
And
Nancy Drew.
And she is basically breaking into where this Chula ambulance is.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, she's not really that good at breaking into heavily fortified areas. And
she's caught.
And she's caught by none other than Algy, Jack's special friend.
Yes.
From the really badly lit up RAF place in episode 1.
I beg to differ. I think it was incredibly well lit up.
Yes. And so basically, Algy takes Nancy into the security shed.
Yep.
And
it's 2 doors left of the kitchen.
Why would you ever want a security kitchen? let's put a pin in the security kitchen, shall we?
Let's do that.
And basically another soldier starts guarding her, and Algy heads out.
Okay.
So then Nancy sees that this other soldier is transforming into a gas mask zombie.
Yeah, she recognizes the scar on the hand, all of the mannerisms. He is slowly but surely turning into one of them. And she begs him, begs to be let out and maybe locked up elsewhere, as long as it's not next to this guy. But it's for naught. She is left there.
And obviously, he's had these physical symptoms, and as we know from the last episode, physical symptoms as plague.
And then slowly but surely, he turns into one of them.
So we cut to the Dr. Rose and Barrowman. They turn up at the Jeweler ambulance.
Yeah.
But they also see, and why they didn't teleport directly onto it, I don't know, but they see that there is guards around the site.
Yeah. And Algy, in fact, pops up as well.
And Algy is the guard. Anyway, Rose offers to distract the guard.
Oh, she's such a slut.
Using the power of her, you know...
her lady boobies.
Union Jack t-shirt and breasts. But Jack recognises him as Algernon.
Yeah.
And basically says, well...
Don't think you're his type.
No. And then
the doctor...
Jack goes off. And then Rose, the little slutpot, is a bit shocked that the handsome
Captain
RAF
Jack.
Time traveller Captain Chunk is bisexual.
Yeah.
And
but the doctor explains he's not bisexual, he's essentially omnisexual. Like, in the future, why would you have limitations?
And he says that the people of the 51st century are more flexible when it comes to dancing.
Dancing. I.e., you're right, this is the bonking doctor. The Doctor Bonks. That's this episode.
So, anyway, the Jack goes out to talk to Algy, and Algy asks him, are you my mummy? Which is probably one of Jack's fetishes.
Probably.
Anyway. And yeah, he starts to...
At that point, I don't understand why he doesn't just unzip right away. It's like, oh, well, I thought you'd never ask, Algy.
And Algy starts turning into a gas mask zombie, which is another one of Captain Jack's fetishes.
Oh, so probably. Yeah, absolutely. But
we're all fine here.
Let's just point out, this effect is incredibly well done. The gas mask that comes out of... At this point,
brilliant.
We see it in profile this time. The last time we saw it from the front, I think. Now we see it from the side, and the gas mask is just sort of, it's growing out from inside the mouth, like from down below in the throat, essentially. It's coming out and the eyes are turning black, and it's, holy shit, it's so creepy.
I think it's very well done. But then the doctor says the infection is the plague, the physical symptoms of plague. Has gone urban.
Yeah. Which, wouldn't that
How
mean that there...
How he knows this?
Yeah, exactly.
How
okay.
he knows this?
Wait. Let's... There are two things here. Coincidentally, I've got two observations. Number one, you've already made the point. How the shit does he know that? Because there is no possible way unless his eyes have, like, built-in microscopes. And number two, because he doesn't know, fucking Algy could have just touched someone, right? He doesn't know.
Yeah.
And number two, doesn't that mean that they're now all at risk? In fact,
yes.
Not just at risk, they're now all infected. Because they're right there. Captain Jack, in particular, was, like, just breathed upon by Algy. Clearly, they are now all infected in that case.
Yeah, but that's not mentioned. But yes, you're absolutely right.
Who wrote... Who had the idea for the logic... Who developed the logics of this episode? I'm thinking it's classic Who Saxons that came up with the logic of this episode.
Oh, yeah. Or maybe the meddling monk wrote a plan on a board. Because it does make as much sense. Because, you know, meet King Harold.
Anyway, they hear, I'm so inside the story, it's like I'm there. Now they hear, or the doctor hears anyway, singing from nearby, and it turns out it's Nancy who is singing a lullaby to the guy who's now already turned into a gas mask zombie, who's handcuffed right next to her, and who is asleep. So it's as though he were her little brother, like the little baby boy, or baby boy, the little boy, and he's now being kept at bay by her singing.
So the doc and Rose rescue Nancy, which is good, and they all go to the Jeweler ambulance.
Yeah.
Where Rose breaks the first rule of time travel by basically telling the person from this time, well, this is an ambulance from an alien world.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, don't worry, I get that you're really pessimistic and disillusioned because there's a war going on and you've been living this kind of pseudo life for quite some time now. But I'm from the future, and let me just tell you right now, spoiler alert, but our side side wins.
So, Rose has turned into Adam again,
mm-hmm.
Basically affecting the past.
Mm-hmm.
This is a bit of a slippery slope here, because, you know, you can't rewrite history, not one single line. We know that. Hartnell said it, and we trust Hartnell.
Oh, you haven't heard my The Massacre review yet, where I redefine that rule.
Oh, and I haven't, and... if you haven't either, go and listen to Classic Who, The Massacre of St. Bartholomew's Eve.
Yeah, damn right. I will give you a spoiler alert, though. It's essentially, it's not impossible, but one ought not to.
Yeah.
He actually says this. In The Massacre, he says this.
Yeah, she shouldn't do it, and she is doing it.
She is doing it. And there's actually no real reason for her to do it either. But it doesn't really matter. Like, what damage can she cause by telling this girl that they're going to win? Because eventually, they are going to win, and she's going to know.
But after, also at this point,
yeah,
we start to see and hear bombs heading in, and there's a bombing raid coming, and, you know, this is the Blitz after all. Jack starts fiddling with the ambulance, and the alarms go off, and the zombies are coming.
I think there's one other thing. Sorry to cut you off, but I think there's one more thing that harkens back to a pin that you popped in the plot in an audiobook review that we did.
Hothouse.
Bingo, exactly. Namely, to do with the barbed wire. Or not the barbed wire, sorry, the fence.
In Hothouse, which was an Eighth Doctor audiobook, we discover that Paul McGann's doctor says, I really ought to get around to making sure that the sonic screwdriver can deal with barbed wire.
Mm-hmm.
And the doc gives Rose the screwdriver, telling her to use this particular setting because that's the setting to reattach barbed wire.
Bingo.
So he's finally put it into his screwdriver.
Exactly. And it all works out.
So, it all works out. Yeah. So, now we get the resolution of the episode. What happens was this cylinder wasn't empty. It's an ambulance. It contains a lot of nanogenes.
Exactly.
The nanogenes, basically, when it crashed, escaped the vessel.
Exactly.
And these are healing nanobots. What they do is they fix people. And we know that one single life was killed when this crashed. Jamie.
The little boy.
What happened was that the nanogenes tried to heal Jamie, but they'd never met a human before, ever.
So they scanned him, essentially, and assumed that this is what a human looks like, which I am really sorry. I get the idea, but to me, it makes no freaking sense. Jesus Christ, what kind of a shitty operation are these nanogenes running? What is this? What kind of stupid moron programmed them to believe that every single creature of any civilization has the exact same DNA? And not to be able to tell plastic apart from skin.
Yeah, they're really thick nanogenes. They're now making everyone into the template that they have inside their system, which is a gas mask on a face.
Yeah.
There's a bit of a problem here.
Oh, there are so many problems here.
Oh, go on.
Okay, all right. So, number one, one of the symptoms of having been, quote-unquote, healed by these nanogenes is that you have the same kind of scarring and injuries as the boy had. That's number one. And you have the same mannerisms as the boy had, i.e., are you my mummy? Are you my mummy? As in, the same memories. The memories, they imply that the boy was alive when he was being scanned by the nanogenes. And the injuries, if the nanogenes are designed to fix people, why would they replicate the same kind of injuries but still render it alive? As in, they have resuscitated this dead boy, resuscitated it. It is now, for all intents and purposes, walking around alive. It has a personality, but it's stuck in that one moment of, like, probably immediately before it died or something. Basically, I think that whoever invented the nanogenes as a concept within Doctor Who needs to make up their mind. Either it heals them or it copies them. But if the boy is dead, then the only way for the boy to walk around and actually have a personality is if they heal. But if they heal, they should be healing fucking everyone. Everyone shouldn't be getting a scar on their hand. In fact, everyone should have a perfectly healed hand. It makes no sense, basically. Why are they not turning everyone into a dead boy wearing a gas mask? Why are they turning everyone into a zombie instead? Explain that to me. I'll just summarize everything in that one point.
Well, no, all of that is very valid. And even slightly further, they should change them into the boy.
Yeah, exactly. Freaking exactly. Obviously.
Not, there should be a million empty child, not one and other people who just have a gas mask and scars on their hands.
Yeah, so clearly these nanogenes can recognize that there are different DNAs out there, right? So if they can recognize DNA, why do they attach the gas mask to the cranium? Why is it a part of the boy? Clearly, they would see, even if they scan the boy, they would go, okay, so everyone wears a gas mask. Then fine, every zombie or whatever would be wearing a gas mask. They wouldn't be a gas mask.
So... what happens now is Nancy basically says, oh, look, the zombies are coming.
Yeah.
It's like a Walking Dead. It's a Walking Dead reunion.
Yeah, they're coming to get you, Nancy. Wait, hang on. Why did we never make that joke in Classic Who with Barbara? Why did we never do a they're coming to get you, Barbara joke? Oh, Flapjack, are you listening to this? Do you realize the potential humor that we missed out on? Anyway, yeah, carry on.
The doctor points out that this isn't just an ambulance, it's a military ambulance. So the nanogenes, and this gets even more silly, don't just fix people. They're basically designed for soldiers.
Yeah.
So this is why Jamie
can talk
through radios and has superhuman strength.
Yeah.
He does not say, this is why he can talk through radios, have superhuman strength, and has magic telekinesis and clapping monkeys.
As all Chula warriors know, having the ability to control wind-up Duracell monkeys is imperative to winning any battle.
So a bomb is about to destroy the cylinder because that was Captain Jack's plan in the first place.
And then we get another tiny little bit of exposition. Sorry.
Explore it away.
Yeah, as all this is happening, as the bombs are arriving, as we get the tension of, holy shit, it's all gonna blow up, the fat lady is about to sing, the doctor turns to Nancy and goes, how old are you? You're older than you look, aren't you? Is this really your kid brother? You lost someone. Who was it? Was it Jamie? Who is Jamie to you? And we learn Jamie was her son, not her kid brother. So when he says, are you my mummy? He is essentially asking, are you Nancy?
Exactly. So at this point, Jack teleports up to his ship to try and deal with the bomb. And the doctor goes, and this is something that Stephen Moffat does to the point of ridiculousness in later episodes, most notably Matt Smith's era.
Okay.
Most notably, The Rings of Hackett Henton.
Oh, I don't like that one.
No, neither do I. It makes no sense. And basically, our episode is about to be solved by the power of love. Nancy is told by the doctor to go and hug the empty child because he's looking for his mummy. So, oh, look, you're his mummy. Let's put the two of you together and see what happens. So
I think in a way it does make sense, though. It makes sense in exactly the same way as the, hey, go to your room.
Oh, no. This bit actually makes sense. As I said, this makes sense, but Stephen Moffat starts to overuse it.
Okay, yeah,
in
fair.
Later episodes.
Very fair.
And she goes and hugs him, and then the nanogenes are basically touching them both up.
Yeah.
And
hot.
And basically...
Carry on. I've got a button fly. This might take a while, but just carry on.
The doctor explains that what the nanogenes are doing is they're... learning. They're analysing the parental DNA from Nancy and basically realising, oh, we fucked up with Jamie. And the doctor then runs forward, removes the gas mask, and Jamie is alive, well, and healthy.
Yeah, he is now just a regular boy. Would you not think that maybe analysing any human being, as in whenever anyone else is in contact with the nanogenes, wouldn't that be sufficient information for them to realise that, oh, you know what, the species on this planet doesn't have a gas mask on its face?
Yes, but it almost makes sense. It makes sense enough for me not to question it.
Sure, fair. Okay, fair. I'm being overly sensitive.
And then the bomb arrives. But Captain Jack, at the very, very, very last minute, just when the bomb is maybe 5 meters above the crash site...
Yeah. He's suddenly riding it.
He tractor beams it.
Yeah.
And yes, he is riding the bomb.
Yeah, it's like, I can't remember his name. It's like the fat guy in Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah, it is. And so he's going to dispose of the bomb. By the way, what's written on the side of the bomb?
Bad Wolf?
Yes, it's actually Schlechter Wolf.
Ah, Schlechter Wolf.
Which is bad.
I was literally just guessing there. I could not remember what it said.
Yeah, it's Bad Wolf in German.
Schlechter Wolf.
And he basically says, love your t-shirt, Rose. and then zooms off on his spaceship.
Nice.
Because the bomb is going to explode anyway, and he's going to go and basically take it somewhere safe and blow himself up.
Well, I don't think he plans to blow himself up, but he plans to blow it up somewhere else.
Yes, but we find out later. We'll come back.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to meet that version of JD and myself, just fast forward 15 seconds. Anyway, let's carry on.
Anyway, the doctor sticks out his hands and starts fiddling with nanogenes.
Yeah, this is ridiculous.
And says, oh, all the nanogenes are now upgraded to Windows 7. I'm going to email the software upgrade to everyone.
And then he fucking the last airbenders these nanogenes at all the oncoming zombies. It is ridiculous. It's like the Dragon Ball Z film adaptation, which for the record I have not seen. He shoots them off at them. It is ridiculous.
And
I'm sorry.
He fixes everyone. The gas masks are all just gas masks. And one of Dr. Constantine's patients, missing leg, has grown back.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a couple of things. It's my turn. It's my turn for a little nanogene rant now.
Okay.
So the first one is, after the way that these nanogenes work, and the fact that they have been software upgraded to realize what humans are.
Mm-hmm. Are they not all connected, by the way?
Yeah, seems to be. So they've all been upgraded.
Yeah.
And the way that we have learned that they work, putting the gas mask on the face and putting the physical symptoms on people's hands. Yeah. Surely what they should do is basically turn everyone into a perfectly human Jamie. Because at the moment, you know, the inconsistent child and the illogical nanogenes are just not making that much sense. How they work makes sense. And, you know, fixing the people properly is how they're obviously meant to work.
Sure.
But the fact is, they've been so inconsistent during the rest of the episode that wouldn't have surprised me. And anyway, why not just de-age people rather than regrow limbs?
Yeah, exactly. That's very right. The only two people that they seem to recognize as plausible test subjects are Jamie, who's a tiny boy, and his mom, who is so young that she's mistaken for his sister. So clearly age to them, like old age, would be considered a symptom of weakness in a way, like damage.
Exactly. Oh, and there is a bigger problem here. These are Chula military nanogenes.
Everyone
should have super strength.
Exactly, and telekinesis.
And clapping monkey control.
You're right. Holy shit, mind equals blown. Everything, everyone should now be a super soldier.
Yes.
Oh, god damn it. Moff, I hope you're listening to this. I need an explanation right now. Email me.
The other thing about this bit of the scene, and the Doctor is having a really, really special moment here about how, give me this one day where everybody lives.
Yeah.
It's actually quite interesting. In Doctor Who, there have been precious few episodes where there hasn't been at least a death. At least one day. Very precious few.
Is that true? Holy shit, really?
There aren't many. I think there's like a handful. Up until this point, there's a handful. And this is why everybody lives and no one dying in the episode is actually such a big deal at this point. Because, you know, if you think back to, you know, the Hartnell era, I think you can count maybe two episodes and it doesn't get much better in the other Doctors.
When no one dies.
Yeah. You've got Edge of Destruction.
Yeah. That was the only one I could think of up until this point now. Okay. That's interesting.
I think there's almost certainly no Pertwee or Baker ones where it happens. It's so rare. It's not even funny.
That's a crazy interesting observation. Okay.
But after this episode, it happens quite a bit. And it happens mostly in Stephen Moffat-written episodes.
Okay. Interesting. Okay.
Now, we skip to Captain Jack. So, Captain Jack is in his spaceship.
You forgot the one little bit where the Doctor, in order to protect the timeline, picks up a machete, goes up and chops up the old lady's leg.
Yes, so did Russell T. Davis. He didn't put that in the episode either.
Just cuts it off.
Probably should have done. Captain Jack has a bomb.
Yes.
And the ship, which has a personality, points out that if Jack tries to jettison the bomb, it will explode.
Yeah.
The stasis field, the tractor beam thingy, is decaying, so it's going to explode.
And apparently he doesn't have time to go anywhere else and then sort of abandon ship either. He's going to blow up, basically.
It's 2 minutes. There aren't any escape pods.
I love his plan, by the way. I absolutely freaking love it.
So what's this? Emergency Emergency Protocol 400?
Something like that.
417.
417.
What's Emergency Protocol 417?
Oh, it's a martini. I would like to think a vodka martini. He says, with a little bit too much vermouth. Which is unfortunate because you want to dry as hell. And a couple of olives in there. And he basically just says, oh, activate emergency protocol 4117. And then all of a sudden materializes this beautiful martini. And he is, I have to really point this out, he is so calm. It's as though it's okay because he has this emergency protocol. He doesn't seem regretful at all. There's no like, shit, balls, I'm not gonna find out what I did for those 2 years that I don't remember. Crap, I'm never gonna be able to have sex with a, you know, tree or a beach ball again. I'm screwed, I'm boned, I'm gonna die now. Instead, he just starts sipping his martini and just resigns himself to his life ending imminently. And then, all of a sudden, someone calls out to him.
It is the Doctor and Rose. Boom. Who have managed to arrive without the TARDIS materialization sound.
Yep. Well, arguably, he is, as in Captain Jack, is so incredibly taken with the beauty of his martini. Or possibly he is in fact so composed because he knows that he's going to die very soon, that he has blocked out everything, including the TARDIS noise. And maybe what we're seeing is the interior of the spaceship from the point of view, the perception anyway, of Captain Jack.
Okay, I'll run with that. Okay. So the Doctor and Rose invite Jack on board the TARDIS. Jack comes on, and then the Doc starts dancing in front of the TARDIS.
Yeah, before he does that, he and Rose are exhibiting the crappest form of couples dancing I have ever seen on TV.
Yes, they are.
It looks terrible. They have...
Yes,
I don't
know
if it's deliberate, but they certainly look as though they have no physical chemistry whatsoever.
No, they don't.
And it looks as though the Doctor has no sense of rhythm either.
That is perfectly true.
And then we get a, in my opinion, terrible ending. Up to you. What do you think?
I have an issue with it.
Oh, all right, let's hear it.
Jack caused everything.
Yes, that's
this
true.
This entire episode was caused by Jack.
Yep.
Being a con man. Wanting to, for his own gain, send this Chula ambulance down onto the planet, have a bomb blow it up, people dying, he gets money, runs off. Why is he better than Adam?
Exactly.
Why
what do we normally do with people of that ilk? We normally pop a goddamn plug hole in their forehead and dump them somewhere in the outskirts of London.
And it is only because this is played by Barrowman and frankly has actual chemistry on screen, which Adam didn't.
Yeah.
That he is saved. He is saved by acting ability.
Oh, yeah. Oh, but let's face it. I mean, we are all keen to see more of Barrowman.
Oh, God, yes.
Everyone wants to. If this had been a one-off episode, people would have been crying for the return of Captain Jack.
And there are now. And Barrowman has always said he'll come back to the show at any point he wants.
Yeah, so. And Jesus Christ, yeah. He got his own spin-off series, and people loved that series. So, you know, there was never an Adam spin-off.
Apart from the comic book.
Apart from the comic book, that's very true. Which, by the way, I refuse to read after you told me how it ends.
What, it's got Adam in it?
Yeah, fuck Adam. No, not that it's got Adam in it, that Adam is redeemed as a companion.
Yeah, sad that, isn't it? You know, it's like, sort of like, if you had the sort of like rescuing Catriona from Dalek's Master Plan, you know, a moment after she fell out of the airlock and then redeeming her as a useful companion that went on.
Oh, she was so good. It only took 3 hours of severe instruction to explain to her how, or to get her to be able to maneuver the TARDIS door button. Oh, I hate Katrina.
Reviews.
Wait, hang on. Wait. Before we get to that, the Doctor realizes he now suddenly remembers how to dance. I hate this. I know we pointed this out before, but I have to add something to this. I need to add an element of disdain. I hate this ending. All of a sudden he goes, oh, you know what? Oh my God, Rose, seriously, I remember now. I remember everything. And then he quote unquote dances badly. It's so cheesy. It's so ridiculous. And no actual living being would ever go, oh my God, look at me. And then start like snapping his fingers and bopping left and right. It's ridiculous. Then it ends. Then we throw up. Then it's time for reviews. There you go.
Reviews.
I'm pretty sure. I don't remember exactly. exactly, but I think I started the last time, so it's your turn this time.
Okay.
Unless you remember otherwise, in which case I will rely on your memory.
No, I will quite happily go first.
Go for it.
Science fiction in general on television suffers from a two-part episode syndrome. And you have things like Star Trek The Next Generation, which had The Best of Both Worlds Part 1, which is generally considered to be, if not the, certainly one of the top three episodes of Next Generation.
Which one is that? Is that the parallel universe?
No, it's the first episode with the Borg in.
Oh, okay.
Or the big battle at Wolf 359.
Oh, okay, okay.
And it is generally considered to be one of the top three episodes. And then you have Best of Both Worlds Part 2, which isn't. You have Redemption Part 1, which is generally considered to be a really good episode, and then Redemption Part 2, which isn't.
Which one's that?
Redemption was the Worf Klingon episode.
Sorry, the thing is, I've seen all of TNG, but I don't remember the names of episodes. I apologise.
And, you know, you get to the point where, and it happens in Doctor Who, you have the Sound of Drums, the really good Master episode, which is then ruined by The Last of the Time Lords, the episode after it. Two-parters in Doctor Who, and in science fiction in general, Part 2 hardly ever lives up to the hype of Part 1. If Part 1 was brilliant, Part 2 won't be.
I don't think this necessarily needs to be the case. I think if you have a good enough story, the two parts are in fact not separate entities. They are simply two halves of one fantastic singular entity.
Oh, and I agree, and I made that argument for not doing individual scores for Aliens of London and World War III in reverse, that it would, you know, it's awful. But unfortunately, these were two episodes shown a week apart, and you have the first one, you have The Empty Child, which is phenomenally good. Mm. It is atmospheric. It is, you know, World War II London, it's got bombs, it's got barrage balloons, it's got the Doctor, it's got invisible spaceships, it's got Captain Jack and Rose dancing. It's a great episode.
Yeah.
And then Part 2 has elements of greatness. I absolutely, don't get me wrong, there are some really good scenes. The Doctor, Rose and Jack have obvious chemistry. The resolution to the cliffhanger from Empty Child is brilliant. It's really well done. The scene with the tape recorder, all anachronism aside, is brilliant. It, you know, it is a really well done horror movie. Unfortunately, this ending has so many logical flaws in it. You know, there's just so many logical inconsistencies of, if it does A, then it should continuously do A. Or if it does A, then it shouldn't do B, then C, then D. It shouldn't change its motivation as needed by plot. The inconsistent child and the illogical nanogenes are not just things just to make fun of the episode. They really don't make sense when you actually list what these things are meant to do.
Sure.
All that aside, it is not a bad episode at all. It is the second part of a two-parter, which taken as a whole is quite good.
Yeah.
I gave Empty Child, I believe, a 4.8.
Yes, you did.
It's not up to Empty Child level. You know, it by no means. So there are bits of this which are 4.8, 4.95 worthy. There are bits of this which are 3, if you're lucky, if you try not to worry about the inconsistent genes. So, overall, I don't know. This is a really hard one for me, because I don't want to mark it too high. I don't want to mark it too low. I'd probably say that this deserves a 4.0.
Interesting. Okay.
I think that is the longest it's taken me to come to a decision about.
I think you're right. I think someone called Guinness. I think possibly we have a record on our hands. 4.0, you say?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Here I go. I disagree with you. I disagree with you in terms of this being part two versus part one that we both really, really just thoroughly enjoyed. In my opinion, this is just Act 3, and what we really enjoyed before were Acts 1 and 2. That's it. And Acts 1 and 2 were really, really great, but when they wrote them, when those two acts were written, when they were acted out, when they were produced and filmed and fucking built and everything, and it was amazing, they already knew exactly where they were heading. They knew exactly what Act 3 was going to be, and unfortunately, when you and I loved Acts 1 and 2, we did not take into consideration that someone was dropping trow and shitting all over the pure marvel of this serial in Act 3, or going to be anyway. Here's the thing. You've already pointed this out. There are tons of logical inconsistencies, and some of them were alluded to in Acts 1 and 2, as in The Empty Child. There's the toy gorilla, Duracell monkey thingy, whatever. Makes no sense. We've talked about it in this episode. We have the nanogenes that can't really tell DNA apart from plastic, and they're incredibly sophisticated, but they're also incredibly dumb, and they're very simplistic, and they think everyone's the same, but they don't really, and therefore everyone looks different. Nothing makes sense. There are tons of logical flaws to this story. But it is still, as far as I'm concerned, and this is, again, where I disagree with you, as far as I'm concerned, this is how, agree or disagree, this is how The Empty Child was always meant to end. All that aside, I'm going to say that as well. All that aside, this is the serial, not the episode. This is the double episode that gave us Captain Jack. And even though, fine, we'll never find out anything else about this fantastically interesting backstory of his, the 2 years of sudden amnesia, it doesn't matter. That does not pertain to this serial. I am intrigued beyond belief to find out what he was doing. What was he up to for those 2 years? Who erased his memory? Why did that happen? I love him on screen. He is so charismatic. He's so awesome and badass and sexy and macho and masculine and fucking awesome. Rose and Barrowman have Rose and Captain Jack, or Piper and Barrowman, they have amazing chemistry on screen. And the Doctor and Barrowman, here's one of those situations where you get two characters who are both alphas. They're both alpha males, and they are almost competing for screen time, but we're not keen to find a winner because it's the competition. It's the rivalry of those two characters that makes this serial so incredibly bombastically worth watching. Fuck all the logical inconsistencies. Forget all of the plot holes and whatever. I can't remember what I gave episode one. I think I gave it 4.4. Whatever I gave it. You gave this 4.0. I am going to give this... Shit, I'm giving it 4.0 as well. Okay, because I don't want to go into the threes. I don't want to go higher than that. Yeah, I'm giving it 4.0. But in my view, it's a slightly worse 4.0 than the one that you gave it. There you go.
How? Mathematically, it's the same.
By the same token as the DNA of a son and his mother and literally any other human being on the planet, somehow they can be the same yet completely different at the same time. There you go. In your face, you've just been Stephen Moffat.
Listener minis.
And we have some mini reviews from our listeners. This first one comes from Gallifreyan Buccaneer. How you doing, dude? Everything good? Glad to hear it. Awesome. Gallifreyan Buccaneer, as we mentioned in our last New Who review, has sent in a combined mini for Empty Child and Doctor Dances. Gallifreyan Buccaneer goes. So after just writing my arc review, this story is the perfect counterpoint, displaying exactly what Doctor Who should be. Number one, fun. This two-parter just basks in the idea of being a Doctor Who episode. Maybe it's because it's Stephen Moffat's first episode for Who, and you can just feel him relishing it. Rose hanging from a barge balloon in World War II Blitz. Hell, why not? Playful banter between the Doctor and Rose, and not only that, but fantastically written, intelligent sexual metaphors that get at the relationship of the two. The hilarious cliffhanger resolution that pokes fun at the idea of having one in the first place. Running around a hospital with bananas and square guns, it's just so damn fun.
Number two, it's scary. The child is just plain creepy. The way he repeats the same horrible phrase that just brings home all the horror of World War II era Britain. Gas masks have always looked especially creepy on children anyway, which adds to the effect. The glitchy way he controls objects to call out for an answer, the amazing scene where the tape runs out and he's revealed to be in the room with the TARDIS crew.
And he goes on. Number three, progressive. This is exactly where the arc went wrong. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, just need to interject this. The arc... classic serial. I haven't actually dropped that episode yet, but yes, it's recorded. Yes, it's in the can. Yes, it's going up this week. Just little parenthesis there. Let's carry on with the mini review. Gallifreyan Buccaneer continues. The Doctor here represents the future, and his comments on future humans going out into the stars and dancing is just a great idea. It's such a human thing, and it feels right. We should be spreading the love with other species eventually. Sexual repression is just a bad thing for a society to have, and here we see it in Nancy. She can't admit to being the mother of her own child because she had him young and out of wedlock. The most human thing, a mother's love, is repressed. So what's the resolution? Nancy meeting the monster, quote-unquote, of the story, and telling it, yes, I will always be your mummy. The Doctor hasn't just saved lives, he's bettered this family's life. We also get it with Captain Jack, openly, at least here, bisexual, expressing interest in Rose as well as Algy. Is it condemned? You bet it isn't, just as it shouldn't be.
Number 4, good writing. The nanogenes are naturally brought into the plot, becoming important later. The gas mask zombies are well revealed, their scars and flesh another clue in the overall plot, while we get creepy zombie monsters. On top of this great dialogue, the whole dancing metaphor, the Doctor's reaction to the TARDIS ringing phone, I'm not sure if it's Marxism in action or a West End musical. Those would have been terrible last words. And of course, the beauty of war-torn PTSD Ninth Doctor being able to say, just this once, everybody lives. It's another great moment in season one that just encapsulates the joy of life. The mother is reunited with the son, the lady with a war injury is cured, the roguish captain who sacrifices himself is allowed to live for his good deeds, and the Doctor and Rose dance.
And he concludes, I was going to give this a 4 point something, but I don't care. This story deserves a 5.0. Minor faults be damned. Wow. Okay. As a serial, I might actually agree with you. By the way, busted. This is Future Punk, and I'm afraid JD isn't here with me right now. Fantastic review. Please, let me just get that over and done with right away. Amazing mini review, as per usual. Thank you very much, Gallifrey and Buccaneer. Alan, awesome. And yes, as a serial, I probably wouldn't give it 5.0. In fact, I actually haven't, but I see exactly why you are. It's an incredibly well-written, well-acted, well-produced, and important, both canonically and morally, I suppose, story or serial in Doctor Who. And I particularly like the parallel that you've drawn between the sexual openness of the future and the sexual repression represented by Nancy. I had not really thought about this, to be honest. But yes, you're absolutely right. It is her sexuality that is repressed. It is her sexual history that she cannot admit to. Her repression is equal in caliber to the open-armed way in which Captain Jack approaches sexuality. Very interesting point. I'm assuming that there are some magnificent PhD theses out there covering sexuality as presented in Doctor Who. Very, very curious to read one of those. I'm going to see if I can find anyone. Either way, Gallifrey and Buccaneer, Alan, awesome. Thank you very much. An eye-opener. And not the first time you've sent one of those in. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm pretty sure you'll want to tell Gallifrey and Buccaneer what a spiffing analysis of this double episode he's written here. How can you do that? Get on Twitter. He is at Alan Trussler. That's Trussler with two S's. And tell him hi from me. Okie dokie. Next up, we have Steven. Steve Meister! How you doing, buddy? Here we go. Steven says, going back for a moment to my personal story from my empty child review. I remember that one. Okay, here's the continuation. I had inadvertently traumatized my two younger nieces when they saw parts of this episode thanks to the child. Fortunately, I am a total spoiler hound and already had an idea of how this episode ended on Everybody Lives. So I made it a point to make sure they saw the conclusion of the episode too. Well done. Very pedagogical approach, Stephen. He goes on. To date, all three of my nieces enjoyed Doctor Who to varying degrees and are a bit older now and can handle the tougher stuff. Glad to hear it. Though I do have to be mindful of which episodes I watch with the younger ones, now 11 or 12. For the two younger ones, among their favourites is Tennant's The Girl in the Fireplace. The eldest niece, who already likes horror and suspense, considers the Weeping Angels her favourite Doctor Who monster, and as of this writing, I plan to take my two younger nieces with me to see Deep Breath in the movie theatres. Holy crap, dude, Steve Meister, well done. You've got some very lucky nieces to have you around. Okie dokie, he goes on. Now on to the episode proper. First of all, where else but Doctor Who would you see the hero survive a cliffhanger by demanding the threatening monster to go to its room? Where else would you see a hilarious and awesome moment also come back and bite the heroes right in the backside? Also, Nancy is awesome in how she handles the man of the house and basically blackmails him into letting her go, with gear for her plan too. Yeah. Steve, I don't know. Rewind this podcast and have a listen to what JD and I said. There is another element to that scene that, well, to be completely honest, I don't recall considering the first time I saw this episode either. Okay, doesn't matter. Steven goes on. The threads from the previous episode come together as, just as Dr. Constantine said, Nancy clearly knows more about what's going on than she is telling. She's aware that the child is after her, but it takes the doctor to connect the last dots and make everything better for everyone. The doctor's sheer bliss at being able to save everybody for once, up to and including the apparently doomed Captain Jack, is a sight to behold. Eccleston definitely gets across the feeling that this is something that hasn't happened to the doctor in far too long. One thing I particularly like about Stephen Moffat's episodes, such as this one, is the way he writes artificial intelligences. They are often simultaneously clever, yet very, very stupid. It's almost Asimov-like the way these machines, whenever they're Moffat's monsters of the week, usually are trying to follow their programming in a situation for which it is inadequate. In this instance, the nanogenes are doing exactly what they're supposed to do, but are hampered by both their ignorance of what the humans are and their ignorance of that ignorance. Oh, nicely phrased. I imagine your review will just go to town on all the dance talk between Rose and the Doctor. Hey, how dare you, Stephen? How dare you? We are not that predictable. Okay, touche. Anyway, he goes on. Personally, I found it amusing and it didn't get overused to the point that it got on my nerves. Like Empty Child, I'm giving the Doctor Dances a 4.1. Previously, I think it was JD that mentioned that, Eccleston's two-parters tend to start strong but end weak. I don't really feel that's the case here. This episode was every bit as engaging as the previous, in my opinion, as the mystery unravels and the Doctor saves the day. Steve Meister, Steven, Steve-a-Rooney, Stevie Gamer, awesome review, thank you very much. And thank you very much for continuing your story. I love that you are spreading Doctor Who, the gospel of Who, to your nieces. They are very lucky to have you. And that's a very interesting point about how Moffat tackles AIs. Full disclosure, Stephen, to be completely honest with you, I'm not au fait enough with Doctor... Oh God, I hate to admit this. I'm not au fait enough with New Who, or well, with Doctor Who in general, to know who wrote which episodes. But I will bear this in mind going forwards. And, spoiler alert, I'm absolutely going to have a chat with JD about that, because I have a feeling he'll know... Well, I have a feeling I know that he'll know a lot more about this than I do. And he might even be able to provide some further insights into this. Thank you very much for bringing that up. Very, very good. Awesome mini as always. People, follow Stephen on Twitter. He is at isgamer82. That's 82, the number. No, I don't know why I signed that. See? Stuff like that happens. Thank you very much again, Stephen. And we've got one more. It's essentially a list of bullet points, some stray observations from Robert M. Albrecht, our very first official German fan. Rob Meister, how you doing, dude? Everything good? Yeah? Glad to hear it, man. He says, the big solution for the empty child, Rose has some clever moments. Shooting the floor and rewinding it was a cool idea. Okay. De gustibus, Robbers. The music is very good. Whoa. Great special effects, he says as well. Holy shit, dude. Rob, blowing mind. I cannot believe that I didn't even think about this. JD, are you listening to this? I hope you are. I don't even remember what the music was like. I'm going to have to re-listen to it. Well, I'm going to have to re-fast forward through this episode to remind myself what the music was like. But okay, thank you for bringing it up, Rob. Rob goes on. But to be honest, I don't like it very much. If I am bored, this episode is not on my shortlist to watch again. I watch Doctor Who to get entertained and not get depressed. Interesting. Wait, this depresses you? Rob, seriously, please, get on the website. Send in a more elaborate description what it is about this episode or this serial, this double feature that depresses you. I want to know. To conclude, Rob gives this 4.5 out of 5. That's a spiffing mark, okay? And I completely agree with you. But I want to know if this is not on your shortlist to rewatch. Holy shit, dude, you gave it 4.5 out of 5. That's a pretty good mark, man. There's something very complicated going on with your relationship with the serial. I want to know more about it. I want you to tell me more about it. You need to get on the website and tell me more about it. I don't know why I'm speeding up all of a sudden. It might be all that coffee I just had a moment ago. Apologies, ladies and gentlemen. Robert, thank you very much for your mini. I like it. I want to know more, though. I want to know what it is that entertains and depresses you. And thank you for bringing up the music. I wonder if maybe we could have a bonus episode about the music at some point. Yeah, brainstorming. Anyway, awesome. Thank you very much. And Robert, please, Tell me, are you on Twitter? If so, hit me up on it. I will give you a shout out. In the meantime, ladies and gentlemen of podcast land, go online, Google this dude. If you find him, tell him hi from me. Okie dokie. Thanks again, Rob. Let's get back to the show.
Next time, we head to Cardiff and poor man's M, Annette Badland, is back on our screens.
Oh my God, I'm so pleased. I have been waiting for the farting goddamn abomination of extraterrestrial life to return to Doctor Who to fart all over my favourite series in the universe yet again.
It's Farting Aliens of Cardiff.
Yeah, so, ladies and gentlemen, I don't know whereabouts in space-time you may find yourself, but if you are so far into the future, or at least far enough for that review of ours to already have dropped on iTunes or on SoundCloud or wherever you get a hold of Who Back When, then holy shit, you're in for a treat, because JD and I are going to hate the living crap out of that episode.
Yes.
Yes, we are.
We are.
But, oh my God, wait, JD, are you trying to tell me that Who Back When only covers New Who reviews? Wouldn't it be great if we covered Classic Who and audiobook reviews too?
It would be. We should start doing them.
We should. To the time machine. Ladies and gentlemen, you will be pleased to know, if you didn't already, which you probably do, so this is entirely superfluous information to all of you, most likely, unless you're just tuning in which case, thank you. We also do Classic Who reviews and audiobook reviews, and they are fantabulous, though I say so myself. So check them out. Go to whobackwhen.com, listen to them there, look at our visual index of companions and aliens and foes and spirits and allies and historical figures and pop culture references and all kinds of shenanigans, and it's awesome and it's growing by the day. Leave a comment, leave your own thoughts and whatever, check out the screenshots. Go to iTunes, review and rate us there. In fact, if you leave a review and a rating on iTunes, here's a Who Back When guarantee, JD and I are going to sing for you on the next episode. Yeah, that's going to happen, JD. Stop looking so skeptical. That's actually going to happen. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the first that JD has ever heard of this. Okay, I can't speak for JD, but I promise you I will sing to you. I promise. So leave a rating review on iTunes. If you're not into iTunes, check out SoundCloud. We're there, soundcloud.com/who back when, all in one word. And how can you show your appreciation for the show? Easy peasy. Go to facebook.com/whobackwhen. Again, all in one word. Give us a like. Give us a high five. Say hello. We will say hi back. But that's not all. You like JD, right? I do too. It's okay. You're gonna be fine. You can follow JD on Twitter. He is at Marius Kane. That is Kane with a K.
Yes, it is. And if you wish to have the comic stylings of Ponkin, you can follow him on Twitter at Ponkin. That's P-O-N-K-E-N.
I love the way you spell my name. Yeah, say hi. I will high-five you right back.
And if you, bear in mind, if you follow him, he will give you a lovely comment.
Yeah,
he always does.
Everyone who follows me on Twitter gets a Twitter blessing from me. A personalized Twitter blessing. So thank you so much for listening. We will catch you in the next episode that you listen to, which may be one that we've already recorded. So catch you in the future or in the past. We have no idea. Either way, thank you very much.
It's been wonderful.
Be rad and excellent to each other. Ciao, ciao.
Who Back When?